Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasage. As we say so long to this year and bring in the new year, Bomsida takes a look back at the year and reviews the big news of 2011. We'll take you back to stories in recent memory, like Attawapiskat, then staying in Ontario. There's been a lot going on in the Ring of Fire, then keeping with the resource sector. We'll have a listen to the controversies over Enbridge's proposed Northern Gateway Pipeline. Plus, we'll hear about the struggle to maintain clean water and the fight for a national public inquiry into missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls in the country, and also the lawsuit that has been launched on behalf of Aboriginal people adopted during what is referred to as the 60s scoop. So hear these stories and more, along with great tunes, right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. Attawapiskat First Nation Chief Teresa Spence has filed an injunction against the third-party manager. The injunction has been filed following a meeting with Aboriginal Affairs Minister John Duncan. According to Post Media News, the chief told media that the meeting didn't go as well as hoped because the two parties still disagreed on the issue of the third-party manager. The chief is unhappy about the salary for the third-party manager, who is to work for $1,300 per day, with the band footing the bill for the government appointee. Meanwhile, Timmins James Bay MP Charlie Angus says the meeting in Thunder Bay between Attawapiskat and Minister of Aboriginal Affairs John Duncan made things worse for the impoverished community. Angus sees the third-party manager as punishment to the community for speaking out, and Liberal leader Bob Rae visited the community last weekend. Rae told media that Prime Minister Harper lacks respect for the community. A spokesperson for the PM's office said Harper will not be visiting the community, but the top priority is to get help to Attawapiskat. A United Nations official has recently criticized Canada for its handling of the crisis in Attawapiskat. In a statement, James Anaya, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, said he was concerned about the dire and social condition of Attawapiskat First Nation. Anaya also noted the third world conditions of Attawapiskat and other First Nation communities in the country. He also pointed out that these conditions exist despite Canada's position in top countries with good human rights records. Anaya added he will be monitoring the situation. In Manitoba, educators from teachers to principals and deans met last week at a conference to find ways to reverse the poor state of education for Aboriginal people in the province. The Winnipeg Free Press reports a host of social-related problems contributes to the province's dropout rate of 30-35% for Aboriginal students. The Treaty Commissioner for the Treaty Relations Commission of Manitoba says resources are being developed for teachers to teach about treaties. Currently, grades 5 and 6 are taught about the treaties. A lawyer in Saskatchewan says she is going to donate a third of her fees from residential school abuse cases to set up a fund for victims in the province's north. The Star Phoenix reports Lisa Abbott represents about 130 residential school victims. The money will go into the Athabasca Healing Fund, which will be launched early in the new year. Abbott is also hoping to leverage funds from other companies and individuals. Lawyers for residential school abuse victims receive a fee of 15% of any abuse settlement directly from the government, and the Star Phoenix reports that some lawyers also bill the former student for a further portion of their settlement. Abbott is a member of Pelican Lake First Nation and wanted to do more to help the former students of residential school. Meanwhile, thousands of Aboriginal people in Newfoundland and Labrador have won the right to launch a class action lawsuit against the federal government. The lawsuit is based on their claim that they were unfairly excluded from the residential school compensation settlement. CBC reports the court backed the certification on Wednesday, December 21st. CBC also reports the federal government is denying any responsibility for the treatment of Aboriginal children in Labrador because the schools there weren't fully funded by Ottawa. It's estimated about 6,000 people will be covered by the class action lawsuit. The North Shore Tribal Council in Ontario strongly rejects the proposal that the North Shore of Lake Huron become a site for nuclear waste storage. In a statement, Chief Lyle Sayers, chairman of the Tribal Council, says natural disasters sometimes happen, such as what we've seen in Japan, and it could make the whole area a nuclear wasteland suitable only for that industry. The Tribal Council has sent a message to the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission and to the Nuclear Waste Management Organization that the groups shouldn't bother spending money on a study since nuclear waste will not happen in the area. And according to the Elliott Lake Standard, in mid-November, a delegation of 21 business and community leaders from Elliott Lake, Blind River, the Township of the North Shore, and Serpent River First Nation attended an information session in Toronto hosted by the Nuclear Waste Management Organization. Lake St. Martin First Nation members in Manitoba will soon move into temporary homes on a radar base near Gypsum. The community of over 700 had been evacuated since last spring due to flooding. Nearly 500 of the community members had been living in Winnipeg hotel rooms. The province is purchasing 150 modular homes, which will go on the old radar base. The new temporary home is not far, 10 kilometers from the First Nation. The Winnipeg Free Press also reports that residents recently expressed concerns that the temporary home may end up being permanent. Plus, they fear the temporary site is in the middle of a garter snake migration route. In BC, the majority of Gitxsan hereditary chiefs have decided to shut down the Gitxsan Treaty Office. Two-thirds of the 40 hereditary chiefs have also signed a declaration stating any deal the Treaty Office struck with Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline is null and void. Head staff have been fired, plus other staff will be laid off when the Treaty Office no longer exists. The chief and clans met after hearing about a deal the Treaty Office struck with the pipeline company for $1.7 million earlier this month. Chief Norman Stevens says besides the deal being bunk, the resources being protected are priceless. He says there's no price on fish or fresh water. A project to build a residence for First Nation high school students in Thunder Bay is underway. The Chronicle Herald reports the project is being spearheaded by Wasaya Group. The student residence would ease the transition from remote First Nations youth attending Dennis Franklin Cromarty High School. There have been 17 deaths in Thunder Bay over the past 11 years, as well as a call for a provincial inquiry to look into the teen deaths. The teens were all from remote communities without a high school to call their own. First Nations youth attending school in Thunder Bay have told Wasaya a group that a student residence in the city would help. Currently, the group is fundraising capital for the proposed 200 resident building, plus looking at plans for a youth drop-in center. The ban on narwhal tusks has been partially lifted. CBC reports the Department of Fisheries and Oceans Canada has partially lifted its international trade restrictions on narwhal tusks. The federal government and Nunavut Tungavik Incorporated have been working on a plan to help settle a dispute over the ban. The ban was imposed last year on 17 Inuit communities. The narwhal management plan won't be released until 2013. A First Nations map has been sold at auction for 10 times what it had been estimated to go for. CBC reports a carved Tlingit mosquito mask has sold for $400,000 in a Paris auction house. The 150-year-old mask is probably headed to the private collection of an unidentified European collector. 1812 hero and Shawnee Chief Tecumseh will be commemorated on a Canadian stamp next year. A Great Lakes freighter will also be named after the leader. CBC reports the honors commemorate the Bicentennial War of 1812, in which the chief played an integral part. Canada Post will also issue a stamp to honor Sir Isaac Brock, a general considered to be Tecumseh's ally in the war. There will also be a ceremony next June for the unveiling of the Chief Tecumseh stamp in Tecumseh, Ontario. And that's your National Aboriginal News. I am the one to hold your hand, and you are the one who understands. What if I meant words I was spoken? And two. Mock with What If We Could. We're going to start off the 2011 Year in Review with youth. We first heard about this story in May. It's when the body of missing teen Jordan Wabas was found. Thunder Bay police said the body of the 15-year-old was found in a river. Wabas was last seen getting off a bus in Thunder Bay on February 7th, a block away from his boarding house. The young Webequay First Nation citizen was living in Thunder Bay to attend high school, hundreds of kilometers away from home. He was the seventh teen to have died since 2000 while living in Thunder Bay to go to school. First Nations teens come from remote northern First Nations to attend high school because there's no suitable schools for them in their own communities. Howard Hampton, the MPP for the Kenora Rainy River riding in northwestern Ontario, which covers Thunder Bay, said back in May that a provincial coroner's inquest into the drowning of a 15-year-old in October 2007 had been delayed, and that, Hampton says, is unacceptable.
Well, these are seven teenagers who've come from some of the remote First Nation communities in northwestern Ontario to Thunder Bay to attend high school. And over the last 10 years now, seven of these young students from First Nation communities have disappeared while attending high school in Thunder Bay, and then later turned up deceased. And my question of the Ontario government is, has the government taken any action whatsoever? Response from the government is that they have an inquest underway, but in fact the inquest is not underway, and it's delayed indefinitely because the Ministry of the Attorney General of Ontario failed to ensure that the coroner's jury was a representative jury. Representative meaning, in this case, that there were First Nations persons on the jury. Since there is a significant First Nation population in the city of Thunder Bay and in the region surrounding Thunder Bay. So, in essence, seven young people from First Nations have disappeared in Thunder Bay and then turned up deceased. And the government has done not much of anything. And the point I made was, if seven young people, high school students, disappeared, say, in the city of London, Ontario, over a period of time, the province would have said, hey, there's a problem here, and we need to look at this and do something about it. Similarly, if seven young high school students had disappeared and then turned up deceased in a city like Oshawa, about the same size as Thunder Bay, if it had happened there, I'm quite sure that provincial authorities would have said, this is really unusual, this is alarming, we need to have a close look at this and see what can be done to prevent this, and we need to get to the bottom of this. So my question was, you know, why this lack of attention, why the seeming nonchalance when it happens with respect to seven First Nation youths in the city of Thunder Bay.
That was Howard Hampton, MPP for the Kenora Rainy River riding, and in September, the Anishinaabe Nation called for a public inquest to address deaths of seven First Nations youth in the city of Thunder Bay. Anishinaabe Nation Deputy Grand Chief Terry Wabus.
Well, firstly, there was a ruling on Friday by Dr. Eden that concluded that the jury role for Thunder Bay was invalid with respect to First Nations representation on its roles, and that affected the Bushy inquest, which was to have started in January of 2009. It's taken for the province of Ontario to come to this conclusion that even though we've been trying to work with them, telling them that there's a problem, and so with today, we didn't specifically talk to with respect to the Bushy inquest, but what we did this morning here in Thunder Bay is call for a commission of inquiry to look at the circumstances of the seven First Nations from the Nan area that have passed away while attending school here under the same circumstances or under similar circumstances as did Reggie Bushy a number of years ago. So what we're saying is that at the ruling on Friday, the coroner's inquest system obviously is not sufficient to get to the bottom of what the families are trying to find answers to as to what happened, not only in Bushy, but also to the other young people.
Julian Falconer is the lawyer that represented the Anishinaabe-Asque Nation for the inquiry into the death of Reggie Bushy. He says since the truth is out about the lack of Aboriginal representation, something can be done, and a commissioner's inquiry into the deaths of the seven other teens that died in Thunder Bay can be looked into.
The reality is that the jury rollout here is invalid. There has been a systemic exclusion of First Nations for some years. The truth is finally being told about that, and that's important. Certainly Nan wants to see it fixed, but you can't fix something if you don't identify it. Dr. Eden, the coroner on the Bushy case, gave a ruling on Friday, just this past day, on the issue. And it's really that final reality that has prompted the executive at Nan to take a leadership position and to call on behalf of all the families and the communities for a commission of inquiry to look at these seven deaths and to tell the story of these seven youth and to make sure there's nothing sinister going on, but at the same time to analyze the systemic realities that attach these deaths.
Meanwhile, the province didn't approve a commissioner of inquiry to look into the teen deaths in Thunder Bay. However, former Supreme Court Justice Frank Iacobucci is reviewing First Nation representation on Ontario jury rolls, and his report is expected next summer. This is BOMCEDA's year-end program and reviewing top Aboriginal news stories from this past year. Now we'll turn to the controversies that have been surrounding Enbridge's proposed Northern Gateway Pipeline. The $5.5 billion project would see over 1,000 kilometers of pipeline built from just northeast of Edmonton to Kitimat, BC, crossing over the traditional territories of more than 40 bands. The company offered a compensation package which included a 10% equity stake in the profits of the project, as well as a good percentage of jobs and other perks. And all that doesn't matter to First Nations with the Carrier-Sicani Tribal Council. And Vice Tribal Chief Terry T.G. says it's the environment that matters.
Yeah, essentially our opposition is, in terms of this project, is just that we, our people, don't support this project, concerned with the risks to the project and the fact that Enbridge has a history of breached pipelines. So that is our opposition to this project.
And so the company's been offering a compensation package which includes a 10% equity in the project. And what's your position on that?
We won't accept any benefits package. My people have told me that it's not worth it. Plus all the other concerns in regards to the environmental assessment is just really that our people have stated no to this project for 5 years and we continue to say no.
That was Terry Teagee, Vice Tribal Chief with the Carrier-Sicani Tribal Council. And earlier this month, there was a split within the Gitxsan Nation. There was a press release from the Gitxsan Treaty Office in northwestern BC. The Chief Negotiator and Hereditary Chief Elmer Derrick announced a $1.7 million deal with Enbridge. But all that was bunk, according to Gitxsan Hereditary Chief Norman Stevens.
We'll start with the announcement that came out on Friday. The Hereditary Chiefs were not aware that Elmer was actually negotiating with Enbridge. And we weren't prepared to hear an announcement of an agreement with Enbridge. We most certainly were not in approval of any agreement with Enbridge. Since that time, the chiefs have met, the three clans have met on Sunday, and they had unanimously decided that the action should be taken. They should voice their disapproval with the Enbridge agreement, but also that the three negotiators, Elmer Derrick, Bev Clifton Percival, and Gordon Sebastian, the executive director, should be terminated immediately, and that the Gitxsan Treaty Society office should be closed. After the Klan meetings on Sunday, there was an all-Klans meeting held later that evening to reaffirm and make a plan of action. And what came from that meeting is that we would take this action on Monday. So we met Monday morning, had some discussion on it, and reaffirmed that this was the action that we had to take. And from that meeting, we did a walk to the Gitxsan Treaty Society building, and there the hereditary chiefs informed Gordon Sebastian and Bev Clifton. Elder Derek was unfortunately out of town at the time, and we informed him, or the hereditary chiefs informed him, that their services were no longer needed, and they were terminated immediately. And the Gitxsan Treaty Society office was to be closed.
That was Gitxsan Hereditary Chief Norman Stevens. And pipelines are equally unpopular south of the border. Marty Kobanes is with the Indigenous Environmental Network in the U.S., and he's been lobbying against the Keystone XL pipeline, which would see a pipeline built from the Alberta oil sands to Texas.
President Obama invited all the 565 tribal nations in the U.S., their chairman, to the White House for a summit, which he has for the last 3 years. We looked at it as our chance to get our tribal leaders in who are opposed to the Keystone XL pipeline to have a word with President Obama and to hand him the Mother Earth Accord that was created by tribal leaders and IEN and other and landowners in Dakota and Nebraska. Basically opposing the tar sands, Keystone XL, the hell, and for many different reasons, the Ogallala Aquifer, the damages that it's doing in Canada, Aboriginal First Nations people, to what it's doing, and to violating treaty rights in both the U.S. and Canada. So it's a strong accord that we have that was created, and that was personally to President Obama by Rosebud President Rodney Bordeaux, to which Rodney, or President Bordeaux, was one of the authors of the Mother Earth Accord also.
That was Marty Kobanes with the Indigenous Environmental Network and the U.S. Now here's a song from a young activist. This is 10-year-old Takaya Blaney with her song, Shallow Waters.
Shallow waters, I can't see your clear waves lapping at my feet. Lifeless ocean, black not blue. I didn't help but deep down I knew. In shallow waters I used to see dolphins playing in front of me. The seaweed swaying, keeping time. Tidal rhythms that not cry. Oh, 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 oh. Why do tears fall from the sky? Oh, oh, oh. We giving up, please tell me why.
Now, we'll move on to the issue of missing and murdered Aboriginal women. For years now, Aboriginal women's organizations in the country have been calling for Canada to conduct a national public inquiry to look into missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Canada after years of mounting evidence of unparalleled violence against Aboriginal women and girls. Canada has remained silent on the issue, but the women's voices have been heard, and just this month, the Native Women's Association of Canada and the Canadian Feminist Alliance for International Action announced that the United Nations Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women will conduct an inquiry into the murders and disappearances of Aboriginal women and girls in Canada. Sharon McIver is with the Canadian Feminist Alliance for International Action.
Well, the UN Committee, the United Nations Committee, is an international committee that reviews the various countries on their performance on the convention. And the convention is the Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. And they have reviewed Canada's performance as in relation to the Aboriginal women, and specifically the missing and murdered Aboriginal women, and found it to be deficient. So under their, what they call the option protocol, they're going to come into Canada and conduct an inquiry themselves. And basically what happened is that as non-government organizations, we've went to the CEDAW committee and asked them to do this because of the, we believe that the Aboriginal women, especially the vulnerable Aboriginal women situation in Canada, is at a crisis. We've got 600 plus documented missing and murdered Aboriginal women with very little state or government intervention. And we believe that the country, the government, does not take an Aboriginal woman going missing. They don't take it seriously. They, you know, there are a lot of situations where they basically tell whoever's reporting, oh, they're just out partying and they're out having a good time, and they don't follow up on it. Ironically, that's what happened in Mexico. That's what gave us the idea. There's an area in Mexico called Ciudad Juarez, and it's an area that had built up because of factories and workers living in the area. Women were going missing, and when they were reported, their families, the police gave a similar response, oh, they're just out having a good time, don't worry about it, they'll be home, and they wouldn't follow up on it at all. And the CEDAW committee, after being requested by human rights groups in Mexico, went in and did an inquiry in Mexico. And so that was, when we saw that, we thought that the same type of thing should happen in Canada.
And so how long did that take?
Well, we've been working on this issue probably for about, well, specifically the missing and murdered Aboriginal woman, probably for about 4 or 5 years now. As you know, the Native Women's Association of Canada had a program called Sisters in Spirit. And what they were doing was basically getting stats, finding out, you know, the women that went missing, the women who had been murdered, the women who have never been seen again, and just keeping track of them, as well as having some contact with their families. As we were able to finally get solid numbers, it was alarming, the number, because as you probably know, as Aboriginal women, we make up about not quite 2% of the population of Canada. If you translate the number of Aboriginal women in the Aboriginal community to the non-Aboriginal women, the percentage would be about 18,000 non-Aboriginal women. And that's a horrendous amount. Because we're such a small group, the number that we have seen is a quite a large percentage of our population. And that nobody seemed to be taking it seriously. We have reports over and over again where they were reported missing, and no one would follow up on it. You know, the families would put out posters. Somebody would be out walking their dog, and they would stumble over the body. And it was someone who, one of our Aboriginal women who'd gone missing, and nobody had followed up on it.
That was Sharon McIver with the Canadian Feminist Alliance for International Action, and that inquiry could start this February. And this is the last episode of the year, and we're taking a look back at top Aboriginal news stories that happened in 2011. Throughout the year, the area known as the Ring of Fire in northwestern Ontario was always a hot topic with lots going on. This past fall, for example, Kitchinimakku Sibininawak issued an eviction notice to mining exploration company God's Lakes Resources. Community spokesperson John Cutfeet says the issues are many.
Last Friday, four of our hunters were out hunting in the Sherman Lake area, which is about 120 kilometers northwest of the community, and they came upon a campsite that they had two tents, and they put people working out in the woods, and they came back and told the community, saying that there are people working out there. Now, one of the things that we had expected was that after what the community had gone through in May 2008 with the incarceration of the Kerry Six, that there would be a different way of dealing with these type of situations, because as it turned out, it was a company called God's Lake Resources embarking on an exploration program without the knowledge and without the consent of Klimek Sibininawak. And so we went there last Wednesday. I believe that would have been on the 28th of September, to go and talk with these people and ask them to leave right away, because they were in fact trespassing on KI spiritual and sacred land. We have burial sites within the vicinity of the old Sherman Lake mine site, and one of them, which is a short 20-minute walk from the actual mine shaft. And when we got there, it looked like whoever was there had broken camp. When we landed, we saw a shed right by the dock where we landed, and we saw a tent, some camping gear, mattresses, Coleman stoves, and among other things. And so we posted the eviction notice that they shouldn't be there because they were there without the consent of KI, and the KI hadn't been properly consulted with this activity that they were embarking on. And we were at the point where we were saying Ontario had gone on ahead and issued out another permit to begin a exploration program without first reconciling KI's interests with other competing interests, as directed by the Court of Appeals in May 2008, when the KI's were released from incarceration. So we went and posted a notice of eviction on God's Lake Resources, and that they were not to go into the territory without KI's knowledge or consent.
That was John Cutfeet, spokesperson for Kitchinimakku Sibininawak in northwestern Ontario. Also, in the Ring of Fire, Mining Watch Canada wasn't too impressed with an environmental assessment process for one project, while one Matawa chief, Peter Munias, spoke to Bombsida about the Aboriginal issues in the area back in October.
Cliff Natural Resources has no respect for the First Nations territories or First Nations people, as far as I'm concerned. The reason why I said that, they have not set foot or called directly, other than the guinea pigs that they use to call us here to do whatever you call that, the shoe in there to, you know?
Mm-hmm.
For them to go ahead and do it, and they call that consultation. We don't want that. What we want is we want our grassroots people to be consulted with prior consent given by them, not by the government. They just go on a territory and without asking, can I have your consent? to work in your territory and work with you guys as partners of the land.
And so have you even heard from government about this specific project?
Well, I heard government a lot of times saying that it's a good project, it's going to bring resources. But to who the resources are going to be coming to? It's the government that's going to get the resource funding, money, or anything financial. First Nations are not going to get anything out of it, you know, the way things are moving right now. That's why we have to put a stand on the traditional lands that we think belongs to our ancestors and our people.
That was Peter Munias, a Mtawa chief. And sticking with resources, we'll hear about one precious natural resources that people the world over need to survive. Water. Bob Seidel caught up with grandmother Josephine Mandaman on May 27th at Nipissing First Nation to talk about the largest Mother Earth water walk in North America.
The journey currently we are doing the eastern water with the from the Wabanaki land, which is in the Atlantic Ocean. That's our journey right now, but I've been doing other journeys, the south, the east, the west, and the north, but right now I was just concentrating on the east to getting it to the center of the lakes, the Great Lakes, which is Lake Superior.
And then what are you going to do there?
We will be putting all the four ocean waters that have been coming but converging into the center from the four directions with the salt water. We'll be putting it into the fresh water of Lake Superior.
And why did you begin this journey?
Why? Mm-hmm. Well, this journey is part of other journeys that we've been working with the water. In the beginning was Lake Superior, which is the fresh water, and then out to the ocean. And then we realized that the salt water also has healing potential, healing elements that is required for salt. Salt is healing, so we are. That's the idea of bringing that salt water to the Lake Superior, not only Lake Superior but the five Great Lakes. It'll be intermingled with that.
That was Anishinaabe grandmother Josephine Mandaman talking about the Mother Earth Water Walk. Now here's Digging Roots with Bring the Water.
Take that bet, 'cause I
wrap up with these two last top stories. Back in September, a national class action lawsuit was filed against the government over the Adopt Indian Métis program, which is otherwise known as the 60s Scoop. Regina lawyer Tony Merchant filed that suit.
About 3.5 years ago, people started to approach Merchant Law Group to sue on their behalf because they had been taken in the 60s and 70s, Aboriginal children, First Nations children, Métis children taken, forced into adoptions frequently in the United States. And as these people became adults, they had lost their culture. They had in many instances been physically and sexually abused, and they drifted back into the Aboriginal culture. And over time, I think a momentum gathered among these people. There are just thousands of them who were impacted in this way. And we became persuaded that through all these numbers that there was a wrong, that the government had been wrong with what was then called the Adopt Indian Métis program, and has within the Aboriginal community come to be known as 60s Scoop or Lost Boys. So we've launched these proceedings in 3 different jurisdictions, and we will be launching across Canada. This is a significant wrong to largely Métis people, but in many instances, First Nations people as well.
That was Regina lawyer Tony Merchant on the class action lawsuit against the federal government on the 60s Scoop. Now, the story that has been grabbing headlines throughout December, it was the call for help from Attawapiskat. Rosie Kustachin is a community member and volunteer in her community, and she spoke with Bombsida about her experiences at home.
The housing situation here in Attawapiskat is there's a lot of overcrowding. There's a lot of families living in the house, maybe 3 or 4 families living in the house. Like I said, it's overcrowding. There's also an issue with the housing because the houses are really old here, built sometime 1970s, and a lot of them are really deteriorating, and they've been getting condemned. That's why it's happening in our community.
And so how has the housing crisis directly affected you, Rosie?
Oh, for me, it has affected me for the housing crisis. Let me just want to share some story how I was back in 2005 and 2006. I was having a housing crisis myself because of my floor caved in. Sometime in January and February, in the cold winter time. So my house was built in 1970s. It was deteriorating after my floor collapsed. So we had media came in, and I was kind of embarrassed about my house, how I was living with my children, but I had to. Had to speak up because I wanted a safe place, a very healthy environment for my children because they were small at the time, and my son was born with a heart murmur, eczema, and asthma. So for me, I blame it on the housing, the health. Like I said, he has a health condition, and I blame it on the contamination also. It could be from the contamination and the mold too, because my house was very moldy. It's really old. So for me, I'm lucky enough to have a house. They only built 2 houses that time, 2 emergency houses when they built my house after it was demolished.
That was Rosie Kustachin, an Attawapiskat community member. You've been listening to Bombsida with Jennifer Ashwasagay. Bombsida is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment in a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bombsida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project 1. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombsida.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bombsida.